This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I have really the great pleasure of talking to Luis Rodriguez about his book, It Calls You Back, that was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Autobiography. It's an incredible book. Luis, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, I'm really, really glad to talk to you. And I think we met years ago when Always Running came out,
yeah.
Which is a kind of precursor to this book, and told the story of your life up to, you know, the early 90s. Now, so that maybe, you know, before we talk about some of the details of it, maybe you could talk a little bit about what you've been doing in your work over the last 15 or 20 years, because you really didn't talk very much about that in the book. It's an autobiography. It's really focused a lot on your early years and, your adventures and misadventures, shall we say, when things were really, when you were much younger and things were more dangerous for you, since you've become straight and, you've got your writing career in hand, that's really more what you've been doing for the last 15 or 20 years. So, just maybe you could talk a little bit about what you do.
Well, I'm a full-time writer, which is a really great privilege. Not too many writers can say they're full-time. And I mean by that is that I work for myself. I travel around the country speaking, doing readings, lectures, and then I write as much as possible. And as you probably know, me and my wife run a nonprofit, an arts, full arts cultural space with a bookstore in the San Fernando Valley section of Los Angeles. So that keeps, and we volunteer for that. Both me and her don't get paid for that. That's just our gift and love for the community.
So do you spend time in Chicago, though? I mean, you go back and forth between Chicago and L.A.?
You know, Chicago's my second home. It's hard to be totally away from it. I spent 15 years here. People here have always treated me well. I've had a great time when I was in Chicago. I grew up in L.A., so I knew eventually I'd have to get back. But I come here all the time because Chicago is a vibrant city, and my son is here. I have grandkids in the area. I have so many friends. So, yeah, I have to keep coming back.
Well, yeah, in the story of the book, or your life, the book and your life are sort of one and the same. So when I say in the book, I mean in your life,
right.
You kind of go through the period where you were living in, you lived in L.A. for a long time, and then got to Chicago in the 80s, is that right?
85 I got here, yeah. Which was a good time because I don't know if you were aware, but the next year the poetry slams began. I came in just as the literary scene was really exploding here in Chicago. Everybody was doing poetry, open mics, venues everywhere, libraries, cafes, bars, bookstores. It was a pretty vibrant place for poetry and literature, and I was glad that I could, inadvertently come in around that time.
Right, that was, I know the most famous person from Chicago is Patricia Smith.
Yeah.
Who you were friends with at that time.
We're good friends. We published her, her first book. She's gone on for bigger and better things, which is really what it should be. So, no, yeah, we're very proud of having that. Well, she's my friends, I'm proud of having a relationship with her, but her work is just amazing.
And you had, you were publishing Tia Chucha?
Chucha Press, which is almost 25 years old, publishing mostly, it started off with Chicago poets because there were so many good ones coming out of that poetry scene. Now, and for many years now, we've published people from all over the country, generally new emerging voices, even though some well-known names are already been published by us, and others want to come along. So I think that's been one of the best things that came out of all that I was doing in Chicago to create this amazing press.
Well, and a lot of, it's funny because in both books, a lot of what you've talked about is your life in, in and through the gangs and being part of Chicano culture and, the rough life that you came out of. But through it all, you've always been an artist, a writer, a creator, and also an activist. And I think it's really important that the writing and the art that you've done is connected to your kind of community activism. It's, you don't just write for yourself and you don't just, you know, speak to an outside community, you bring it back. You know, all of your activity in writing connects to your to community and to building those opportunities for other people. You know, was that conscious on your part, or did that just happen? Is that just who you are as a person?
That was just who I was. Now, here's the thing. I was a very self-destructive young man. And maybe it was linked to being creative. People say it is. Sometimes a creative spirit can sometimes take some very destructive forms. It's hard to say, but I was also into art, music, writing. I loved books, even in the gang, even as an addict, even homeless in the streets of L.A. I used to have books with me everywhere. I used to put them in cubbyholes, underneath car seats, you know, of abandoned cars, wherever I could be. I just loved a creative life, even if I didn't know what it was about. I was also very much interested in justice. I always fought for the underdog. I was always aware of injustices in my community and society. Maybe others weren't, but they really resonated with me. So eventually something was going to win out, and I think in the long run it became that creative, imaginative life that has become my life, with a lot of hard work overcoming all the self-destructive impulses.
So do you feel that your political work, which also I think is an important component of what you, I mean, you've talked about it in your books, but it's also, you know, it's part of your kind of being. You've become not only just someone who's concerned with justice and making things right, but you have studied and worked on political analysis to give context to your ideas. And I assume you're still active politically.
Absolutely. And one of the things that it gave me purpose and meaning, you know, some people find it in churches, some people find it in all kinds of ways. I found it through the movements of the 60s and 70s. I got involved with the most radical wing of those movements. It was an intellectual awakening as well as just a political, being involved in community, socially engaged kind of life. It's helped me a lot because, you know, when you have a cause, it really helps to reconfigure what you do and how you do it. You know what I mean? Sometimes it doesn't, but I think for me, I found it to be very important to have that, because no matter what things called me back, what kind of madness would call me back, I still had this idea that there was a better world to struggle for, and I tried to do everything I could to do that.
Well, and what comes across to me in your book and in the way you write about conflict and social relationships is that everything is informed by a kind of radical love that involves you having to make a commitment to honesty, to self-awareness, to self-understanding, so that you expose yourself, and by doing that, you give yourself power to intervene and to love others and help them see the love in themselves. So I thought, to me, that was very powerful. And I guess I'm curious, you know, is that something that evolved for you? Did you have, who would be the influences for you in the kind of love-centered, love-based political analysis that you carry?
Well, it might be related to all the radical poets and artists that I knew about, like Pablo Neruda, who had both of it, who carried it. All the way to Che, you know, all the way to anybody who, to Karl Marx, anybody who sat down and sacrificed for the betterment of our world. There's so many people. Some of them are Christians, some are Muslims, some are different, you know, political stripes. But I was really gravitated to those who use science and ideas to move things forward. And I think the honesty was important because people get so much lies and BS thrown at them. And you know, my thing is, if I'm going to talk about my story and my life, I'm going to be as honest as I can about me before I jump on anybody else. You know what I'm saying? I have to be honest about what I'm going through. And then from that space, say, okay, what can we do to make it better for everyone in this world? So, yeah, I think I was informed by all that, and it really helped me. My kids got into it. Study and activity combined was the way to go.
But you also, when you talk about yourself, you had, you know, in throughout the telling of your story, you've admitted so many terrible things that you've done, not just, you know, you haven't shied away from them. And I think that's part of what makes these books appealing, that they're, you're not apologizing and trying to or trying to push it all onto somebody other than yourself for the things that you've done that were really destructive and painful to others. You've taken responsibility for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's important. An honest accounting, and because I'm sober now for 19 years as part of my sobriety, I also decided to access a spiritual connection, which I didn't have for 20-some years. I do Native American, Native Mexican spiritual practices. Those are very healing for me. I'm not here to convert anybody. It's not proselytizing here. That's not my interest. Whatever works for anybody spiritually is what they need. But I found it to be very important because it's more connected to the world, to nature, and the healing that I needed, because healing is part of everyone's process. So even if you're politically active, even if you have great goals in this world, great objectives and aims, you also got to consider your own personal transformation along with that.
Well, I think maybe even more so, because it you know, the more you're involved in trying to make social change, the more pain you're going to take on. And so you're, in a way, you're engaging in pain and suffering, not only your own but others, and you kind of internalize it. So it feels like you need to be healed. You need to keep doing that, otherwise I think you become burned out, and right. You know, that's when people talk about empty husks, you know, that's all of the core has been burned out of people from all of that suffering and effort, because it is so difficult and so exhausting to work for long-term social change, because, and especially today, and I wanted to ask you about that, you know, as you, we've seen how the culture and the politics have changed over the last 40 years. You know, to a lot of people who were politically engaged in the 60s and 70s, today can look kind of depressing. And I'm, you know, I'm just curious what your view is of where we are, you know, what is, and you might include your spirituality in that. I mean, you know, I think the, the especially indigenous people's spirituality is very active and aware of what's going on in the world, and is, you know, is engaged not only in the healing of people who practice, but an effort to heal the planet. And I'm, you know, I guess I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm just I'm, you know, I want to know what your, how you engage politically today.
Well, about a little more than a year ago, I helped start this group called the Network for Revolutionary Change, with the task that I don't think anybody else is doing in this country, which is how do you get the leaders, the conscious, organized, practical leaders of the society, of this world, to come together, to think about strategies, education, direction, orientation. This is something that has not been happening, and I'm hoping that I can help with whatever way I can to have that happen. I was also just, as you might know, selected as a vice presidential candidate for the Justice Party, a new party started by Rocky Anderson, who is the presidential candidate. And it serves to me as a forum to really speak on issues about the two-party system, about our economy, about our politics, about which way we're going. I really believe in the imagination now and how to regenerate a whole new sense of what's possible instead of getting stuck to the old ways. You know, the old capitalist, you know, industrial world is dying, and we have to think about where do we go that's really equitable, that's really fair, that's really clean as far as our environment goes, that's really free. So that's the direction I'm going now. I'm finding it very exciting at times.
So, and where is this a political, I mean, is this a an active political party, and where is it
based?
Yeah,
we're in 15 states on the ballot. Most of the states, the rest of them you can write in. We're not as big as the Greens. We're not as big as the Libertarians. They just started last year, but because of the vacuum in the political world, the momentum for the Justice Party has moved tremendously. So Rocky Anderson is becoming a well-known name just on the fact that there's been a need to hear these voices. We're not against the Greens. We're not against progressive Democrats. We're not against anybody. But it's more like, how do we keep raising these issues about what's happening in our country, and not to expect or think we should get less than what we deserve. We deserve the best possible country. And as an example for everybody else, what can be done?
Oh, is there a website you want to give the URL for, just in case people who are listening want to find out more about it?
Yeah, they should go. They should go to Justice Party. Look that up. Justice Party were the only ones on there.
Okay.
And then of course they should always go to my website, because I'm going to be hitting more on these issues, and that's LuisJRodriguez.com.
All right, that's great. So do you talk about this when you go out and talk about the book? Do you also engage with people on political, cultural, and
social
issues?
Yeah, I try to have what I call town hall meetings. I'm doing this all the time. I'm not doing it during election time. I'm doing it, I've been doing this for since Always Running came out almost 20 years ago. I've been speaking on these issues everywhere. And so I tell people, yeah, I'm an author, I'm a poet, but I want to have town hall meetings. And we have really great discussions about crime, gangs, equality, immigrant rights, everything, the jobs, poverty, things that even the presidential debates are uncovering in any significant way. So I find that I'm constantly, people say, oh, are you on a tour? I'm constantly on a tour. I'm constantly speaking. And now that I've been afforded this opportunity to be part of the Justice Party, then I'm speaking as I can around that. So you got to be careful with this, because a lot of nonprofits invite me. So I tell people, I'm not here to campaign. I'm just here to let you know what the issues are. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I think it's really amazing. I would say I've spoken to audiences, a tiny group of people, five people, to several thousand. It's been an amazing journey since Always Running came out. And everywhere I go, people are alive with imagination. People want to hear new things. People seem very supportive to what I have to say. It's been a great experience, and I hope it doesn't end. I hope it gets better and more engaging.
So a lot of what you talk about in your work is kind of cross-cultural. You speak as a Chicano indigenous person, but really a lot of the political work you've done has been with people who are not, in other groups. I noticed in one, there was a great scene where you engaged a conversation with some young white KKK guys, and you kind of, I don't want to say you converted them, but you definitely engaged them in a real conversation about what was motivating them, what the issues were, and tried to help them recognize that the issues were not kind of a racist and, a race war kind of concern, that they were mistaking their attention and putting it in the wrong place. And is that something that you actively work on a lot?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very much involved with the Chicano Latino community. I'm very active. Our culture center is right in a huge Mexican and Central American community. But I have to speak to the whole world and the whole country. I had a column in the Progressive magazine called Writing to America, and it was to really speak to everyone, and especially, I think, people who normally wouldn't speak, so-called racist whites, trailer park white people that everybody wants to put down, African-Americans, inner city, Native Americans, Puerto Ricans, Salvadorians, Mexicans. Everywhere I go, I speak to as many people as possible, middle-class America, whatever that consists of. I've even gone to private schools of rich people, and spoken to their kids. It's the value of kind of opening up where we're going, the seeds of what's possible, using my words, my poetry, my experiences to help others find their own meaning, purpose, and direction.
So I guess the hardest thing I can think of, and this is probably just my inexperience or inability to relate, and that is when you talk to people who are in gangs, whether they're in Chicano gangs or black gangs or whatever gangs they are. I know you still do a lot of gang intervention work, but how do you engage them? How do you get them off of the violence and the kind of, I know the gangs perform a social function if we kind of look at it sociologically, but that doesn't help you when you're talking to people, real people who are really living that life, as you call, as it's known. How do you engage people? How do you get them into a discussion that will help defuse violence?
Well, you got to be real, which means you got to know what they're talking about, what they've been through. You can't go in there. I don't have an anti-gang position. I'm not there to judge or put down what they do or don't do. I know the root of it: poverty, scarcity, discrimination, all these things. But I also think, especially because it helped in me that somebody came to me, that people need to start making. It's a kind of a trap. It's a prison, just like heroin or any drugs. You get enchained by your circumstances. You know what I'm saying? You become kind of like locked in, and I want people to break through those chains, to realize that the liberating of their mind and their spirit and their body is linked to a new life, and that new life has to be about something meaningful. So that's the direction I push the young people. I know some of them have done some terrible things under those terrible conditions, but they need to unchain themselves. I mean, that's the way I look at it. And then find passion, art, practices, anything that gets them to be more full in themselves, more whole and healthy. This is the direction that I try to push everybody, because it took me a long time to get there, and I'm trying to help others find their own ways of getting there.
So does it get harder for you to do this as you get older and you become more distant from the people that you're talking to, just in terms of generational experience, or does that not matter at all?
It doesn't seem to matter too much. I speak to kids all the time. I'm getting ready to speak to some kids at a gang intervention program. I'm going to elementary school tomorrow and a high school, you know what I'm saying, here in Chicago. I don't think that matters that much. I think what I am doing, though, at the same time, is doing more talks to policymakers and people who are actually determining what we do with gangs. I've been speaking more in conferences and to communities that don't know anything about gangs, trying to give them insight, awareness, trying to pull away from this repressive way that we deal with youth in trouble and gangs, because it's just not working. The prison rate is astronomical. It's wrong. So I'm trying to convince others now, as well as talking to kids about what they need to do.
Well, yeah. Well, let's talk about that just for a minute. When you talk to people who are policymakers, and how do you convince them that they shouldn't just seek to imprison, destroy, put away, kind of marginalize the people who are in gangs or in any other kind of criminal enterprise where, it could be drug oriented? How do you convince them of a more constructive approach?
Well, you have to start with some real facts, experiences. My experience has been over 40 years of doing this work, is that every time they put in more prisons, more repression, the gangs got bigger. Kids were being put in prisons, and they are today, for many, many years, for things that years ago they wouldn't be doing that much time. They don't have rehabilitation. This is international, because I was just in El Salvador, where I was trying to deal with a gang peace going on there that has caused like a 70% drop in violence, and it's the only way it could be done when the gang leaders themselves got tired, when they decided to talk. It wasn't done with all the repressive measures that they brought down there to that country. And the violence has gone down and can't stay down, but now they need resources, they need jobs. This is what I'm trying to convince people. Where can we put the resources in these communities, whether it's in El Salvador, Guatemala, or inner city U.S., that kids can have real proper training, education, sense of purpose, and can get decent, meaningful jobs. It's the issue for everybody. It's the issue of our economy. It's the issue that all the presidential candidates have to address. It's really, what are we going to do to take care of the least of us? And to me, this is the way to deal with gangs. Not as, they're all criminals, they're all bad, let's just put them away, but as people who are, they're part of the circumstances that they're in, and they express those circumstances, but yet they're capable, like anybody, to reimagine and also regenerate a whole new way of thinking and living.
Well, I think of this too, that the, if you think about the war on drugs, which is a total disaster and a failure, it's related and both directly in the sense that a lot of gangs are involved in drug trade as a way of financing their operations. But if you look at the people that run those organizations, they're very smart. They're very capable. If they were running a business that was not drugs, they could be doing much more, they could be as smart and as accomplished and doing something positive rather than doing something negative.
Yeah, well, gangsters are becoming more businesslike and corporate-like. They're becoming smarter about how they do what they do. And corporations have becoming more gangster-like. You know? I mean, the kind of corporate theory that we're seeing nowadays. So it's like it's all coming together, and really it's just neither one of them are a good proper response to the kind of world we can have. So I think, but instead of knocking everybody down, just say, okay, where is everything pointing to? It's not pointing to everybody just dog-eat-dog, kill-be-killed, which is the way that inner-city life happens, the way that poor kids what life happens. That happens in Mexico with the drug cartels. We have to imagine there's another way to go. That way, it's not going anywhere. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The drug wars are absolutely right. It's a waste. More drugs are available to our kids than ever before. What good did it do? Billions and billions of dollars just putting people away, and there's still more drugs in our streets than ever before. So, yeah, I think it's a matter of re-envisioning everything and realizing there's got to be a way where we can bring the best out of everyone. I believe in that. I totally think it's possible.
Yeah, I do too. I tend to think that it's going to come about from cooperative action, you know, from people working together, not expecting somebody to do it for them, but taking control of their own lives and the means of their own lives. Well, let's switch a little bit. I want to talk about poetry because you've been involved, you know, not only have you been, you know, you've written a lot of memoir, and you've written a novel, but you've been writing poetry pretty steadily for a really long time. And one of the writers you mentioned in the book, and I want to ask you about others, but you did mention Jack Hirschman.
Right.
And he's not that well known. He's a kind of, some poets know who Jack Hirschman is. Not even all the poets know who Jack Hirschman is.
Oh yeah, they should know about him. Everybody should know about him. But he was a poet laureate of San Francisco, and in the Bay Area, he is known as somebody who is radical, revolutionary, and yet has really impacted the world of letters and ideas. So he's kind of like a mentor. Well, he is a mentor, and he's somebody that I look up to as the way to go. How to bring these words, how to bring social issues, how to bring awareness. He helped me get into with Curbstone, because Curbstone was published my second book of poetry, and they also, as you know, did Always Running. They did the hardcover Always Running, which impacted my life and a lot of people. So it was Jack that introduced me to Sandy Taylor and Judith Doyle and all of them over at Curbstone. So I have to respect and honor Jack's role in my life, but also just the kind of person that he is when it comes to letters and ideas.
So are there other poets whose work you really could point to as inspirational for you, people whose work you really love?
Well, yeah. From William Stanford to Pablo Neruda to, I love everybody that's just, engaged with society and yet still love language, still love putting things together. Theodore Rodke, one of my favorite poets. These are the people that I'm interested in because that's what I've been trying to do. My life with language and words and images, as well as the life of this world. Well, where is it going? Where have we been? And how can we present that to people? I'm not really a poet of just the abstract or, pointing out the beauty of nature, even though I'm totally in with it. Sometimes I spend a lot of time in the darkness more than the light, you know what I'm saying? In the shadow more than where people think the poetry beauty and light needs to be dealt with. I tend to be more in the shadows and in the darkness, but in there I do find light and meaning, and I do find purpose, and I do find something powerful that hopefully I can bring out through language.
Yeah, I think that probably applies to all your work. I think you have the courage to explore darkness and pain and suffering and use that to transform. The words are transformative, and that's what you use to make the art. You're not a, it's sort of, I guess I would look at you as not an aesthetic painter of words. You're more of a builder of words, in the emotional language, that you use. The other scene that I was struck by is that you had worked early in your life. You had been an apprentice in the Bethlehem Steel Factory,
yeah, yeah.
And I kind of thought of that's how I think of you as a poet, working in the, you know, your job was to oil all that machinery and get covered in grease and, you know, really go into the bowels of the factory. I think that's how I see you as a poet. You know, you're
that's a nice way to put it.
Right. Yeah. Well, you're getting dirty, but at the end you come out, you know, with an amazing experience because you've been to a place that a lot of people don't want to go.
Yeah, and you know, if you look at my Theatre Future Press poetry, the people we publish, they're very similar to that. They don't have one particular style. I'm not looking at a certain school of writing. I'm looking at those people who work in that with that material. You know, we're just publishing amazing people, all races, all cultures, and get deep down and dirty, like you're saying. So that's what I'm interested in. You know, unfortunately, Adrienne Rich just passed, and she was very instrumental in my own poetry development, but also a good friend. So people like that, I really admire, you know, very much, and try to see if I can go in that direction.
Yeah, when she died, that was very, very sad. Not that long ago. Actually, she had that great book, Diving Into the Wreck. Yeah. I think that sort of describes what we're talking about.
Exactly. She's amazing. Yeah. It's terrible to lose people like that. But then their legacy is that we got to carry on, all of us.
No, that's true. But, you know, I have thought about that myself, that a lot of the poets whose work I have loved and who inspired me are of an age. Some of them have already passed away. Others are getting up there. So, you know, it makes you remember, you know, that you should talk to them, tell them how much their work meant to you before it's too late.
Yeah, and also people like Sandy Taylor, who open doors for people like us, who worked in the publishing world, who made sure that our voices were heard. You know, that's, as you know, being in that world, it's few and far between those people who take chances on writers like Sandy and others like him. So those have to be honored as well. The poets who are doing that kind of writing, but also the people who say, let's open it up. Martin Espada got published with Curbstone. All these well important poets wouldn't be where they're at if it wasn't for people like Sandy and Curbstone and publications and publishers like that.
No, that's absolutely right. Curbstone is a great press and an example. I've started to do interviews, in fact, with some of the founders of some of the publishers who I think over the last 30 or 40 years have done really important cultural work. And I'm going to be talking to Judy Doyle, I think, later this year to talk about Curbstone, because I think, you know, it was a great, just a great press and one that did amazing work over a long period of time. And I think Tia Chucha has done tremendous work. The fact that you've been able to sustain it for that many years, 25 years is a long time.
No money, but that's the nature of this work. You have to love it. You have to love the writers. You have to think of ways that you can push people like that onto the world. It's great work. I love it. But it's sad that most of us are doing this without any means, but we have to do it.
Well, it's true. And poetry in particular is not, it's always been done, you know, published for love and written for love because there's no money in it. So, you know, you just have to accept that and go on, I think.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Luis. And I want to tell you that this book is very transformative and powerful. And I guess just one last thing before we finish, I can't not talk about the experience that you wrote about with your son, Ramiro. Uh-huh. You know, this is a very painful story for you. And, you know, the fact that he was got into the gang life himself after everything you went through is a terrible irony, I'm sure, painful for you to experience. And then he went to jail, which also had to have been incredibly painful for you. But how's he doing now? I guess.
Well, he's, you know, last night we were doing a justice party event in Humboldt Park, our old neighborhood here in Chicago. And Rocky Anderson was there, who's the presidential candidate, and me and my son introduced us. He's doing very well. It's great. He's active. He's involved in the world. He just got out of prison after a total of 15 years, which is very difficult for anybody. But he's determined to do some major changes in his life and in the world. So he's clean and sober. He's gang-free. He's actually working as a gang prevention specialist. So I'm very proud of my son. But this is, again, it was tricky. We don't know whether that was going to go that way. He was going to the same self-destructive path. Anything could have happened. He took me and his mom and my wife, my current wife, to through hell and back. But now we're together as family, and we try to help each other and realize, you know, everybody's worth saving, everybody's worth struggling for. People were trying to throw away my son, like, you know, he will never do anything good, and look at him now. And anybody, it's not really just my son. Anybody's kids need to be looked at differently and helped and given as much love and support as possible. So I'm very proud of my son, and I'm really glad you mentioned it, because that was an important part of the story of What Calls You Back, is all the activity, all the art, everything, but don't forget your kids. You know, you can't, you know, like the right wing, you like to say it's all about family. And of course, it's actually all about all of it. Family, community, society, you know, you can't really let any go, but you can't forget about how important family is.
I think that's a really good lesson, and I think you lived that lesson. I think you know, for somebody to read this book, I think they, you know, it is a great story about how you discover who you are, but also who you're connected to and what your responsibilities are and what their responsibilities are to you. So I you know, the creation of family and the network of culture is one and the same.
Yeah,
I think it's a great story. Well, I really appreciate your talking to me, Luis. It's a wonderful book. It's called It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. I really recommend it to everyone. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, and thank you very much.